Hello, and welcome to the On Science podcast. I'm NPR science editor, Alison Richards. This week, we think small and even a bit fantastical. We have stem cells, bacteria that might solve crimes, an amoeba with a split personality, and algebra in Alice in Wonderland. We begin with stem cells. President Obama's stem cell policy has been in place for a year now. It was supposed to make it easier for researchers to use federal funds to study human embryonic stem cells. But now scientists are facing an ironic situation. Some of the stem cells that were okay to study under the Bush administration are now off limits. Nell Greenfield-Boyce explains.
Julie Baker is a geneticist at Stanford University. She recently applied for a new grant from the National Institutes of Health. It's all done online. She filled out the forms, tried to submit them. But Baker kept getting an error message.
So then, of course, I panicked. we had to try and figure out what was going on.
This was the trouble. Her application said her lab would be using a stem cell line called H9.
It looks like the H9 line, which is the line that we use for 99% of our work, is no longer on the NIH registry.
The NIH registry is important. It lists the only human embryonic stem cell lines that can be studied with federal money. Under the Bush administration, H9 was on that list, so lots of researchers used it. But H9 is not on a new list put in place under President Obama's policy, which was supposed to loosen restrictions.
It's a huge setback because we've spent about 6 years studying the biology of that particular line.
Baker says she's baffled by this turn of events. Labs can't switch cell lines overnight. It takes months to get new cells growing. Lots of experiments will have to be redone.
I mean, for 10 years, the government told us to use a handful of lines, and now they're telling us we can't use those lines. So they've just wasted millions of dollars and lots of resources, which just seems outrageous to me.
And H9 isn't the only cell line from the Bush years that's missing from the new list.
It's interesting to see that of the original 18 lines, only one has made it onto the new stem cell bank, which we could call the Obama Bank.
Christopher Scott directs Stanford University's program on stem cells in society. He says the whole field of stem cell science has been built up on a handful of lines from the old list.
If these lines are not grandfathered and put on the registry, then we'll be back to the Bush years where researchers will have to be very, very careful about setting up their labs in two pieces.
With one side for federally funded work and the other for cells that aren't on the list. To try to understand what's happening, I spoke with Francis Collins, the head of the NIH. He says the new policy does give federally funded scientists access to more stem cell lines.
There are 43 approved lines, and there are 115 more that have been submitted that are in the works of being reviewed.
To check things like whether embryos were donated with proper informed consent. And it turns out, this review process is the critical sticking point for the old cell lines. Collins says, to be consistent, the old cells can't be grandfathered in. Nothing gets on the new list without an ethical review. But only a few of the Bush-era lines have been submitted for that.
We certainly have done everything we can think of to encourage those who developed those lines to submit the information.
He's eager to get a submission for the popular stem cell line H9.
We have been hearing for weeks that an application for H9 is imminent. And frankly, we're kind of frustrated that we haven't seen it yet. So you should talk to the folks who derived that line and find out why they haven't done it.
Those folks would be the Y-Cell Research Institute, linked to stem cell research at the University of Wisconsin. It did apply for and get NIH approval for one of their old lines. Executive Director Eric Forsberg says that line was made with an embryo from the University of Wisconsin, so they had documents for the NIH application. But he said H9 and some of the other old lines came from embryos collected elsewhere.
So we have to work with another group to obtain the correct documents, which is what we're doing now.
He declined to name that group, but it's clear from a published research paper that the embryos came from a scientist at a medical center in Israel. I called him to see if he knew what was holding up the application. In a brief conversation, he said it's a matter of paperwork. I said, scientists are worried that they'll no longer be able to use these important cells. He said, tell them they will. Back at Stanford University, though, Julie Baker feels like she has to start getting some other stem cell lines.
Just for backup, just in case H9 disappears altogether, which would be tragic from our point of view.
She says she hopes that won't happen, but right now, she has no way to know. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Now, here's a scene you'll recognize if you're a fan of CSI.
The suspect we're looking for is a blonde female.
Would you mind giving us your fingerprints and a DNA sample?
Actually, yes, I would mind.
Sometimes it's not a bad idea for real suspects to say no. Police use DNA from blood or skin samples to identify criminals. Most of the time, this analysis is done on human DNA. But science correspondent Joe Palka reports that scientists also think DNA from bacteria may someday find its way into the courtroom.
Most of the cells in the human body are human, right? Wrong. Turns out the human body is awash in bacteria, in our gut, on our skin. In fact, there are many more bacterial cells in and on our bodies than human cells.
As far as I'm concerned, the human body is just a large microbial habitat.
Noah Fuhrer is a biologist at the University of Colorado Boulder. Microbes like bacteria are his thing.
But most of these are harmless, and some of them may actually be beneficial. So it's nothing to be paranoid about.
Scientists have recently become very interested in the variety of bacteria that colonize us because they feel it may explain why some people get sick more than others or some people gain more weight than others. Fuhrer's been studying the bacteria on our skin. There are about 100 different kinds, and that gave Fuhrer an idea.
We leave this trail of bacteria everywhere we go, and the idea was, could we use this trail to identify who had touched a given object or surface?
The reason this bacterial trail could be used to identify someone is that we differ in the kinds of bacteria we carry around.
The bacterial communities on your skin are very unique to each person.
And there's another factor that makes bacterial analysis a potentially useful tool. Our unique bacterial communities don't change very much over time.
The bacteria we're going to find on your hand today are going to be pretty similar to those we'll find on your hand 4 months from now.
So here's how it would work. Let's say you wanted to find out who's been using a particular office computer.
We could swab a keyboard key, for example, pull the bacterial DNA off that swab, and then identify all or nearly all of the bacteria that make up that community.
So that's what they did. They swabbed individual keys from 3 personal computer keyboards.
And then matched those keys to the bacteria on the fingertips of the owners of the keyboards. And we showed that we could basically identify whose keyboard it was pretty well.
Fuhrer then tried a similar experiment with people's computer mice, and he found he could match the mouse to the owner. The findings appear in the current issue of the journal PNAS. In one final experiment, Fuhrer found that they could still perform an analysis of bacterial DNA 2 weeks after it had been left on a surface. Fuhrer says he's already had some informal discussions with law enforcement agencies about his bacterial ID techniques, and there's been some interest in this approach. But Fuhrer's the first to say it's not ready for the courtroom yet.
There's a lot of work that we need to do to figure out how accurate it is and what are the limitations and so forth. But yeah, it's encouraging. It does seem like we can actually take advantage of that uniqueness of our bacterial communities.
Note to all you potential criminals out there, this is just another reason to wear gloves before committing a crime. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
Bacteria. You might not see them.
The film Alice in Wonderland continues to rule the box office. The book has been popular since 1865, the year the world first met Alice, the Dodo, the Cheshire Cat, and of course, the Mad Hatter. Jackie Lydon and Stanford Professor Keith Devlin discussed how the tale's popularity was really largely due to algebra.
Well, as you can see, we're still having tea. And it's all because I was at my special time waiting for your return. You're terribly late, you know. Naughty.
That's a C scene from Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, a version of the story in which an older but maybe not wiser Alice has returned by way of the rabbit hole, getting on to the fraptious day. But there may be more to the story than talking, time-keeping rabbits, and smoking caterpillars. Lewis Carroll, whose real name was Charles Dodgson, was a mathematician at Christ Church College, Oxford. He actually ferried the real Alice Little and her sisters down the River Thames while telling them this story. Mathematicians say that Alice in Wonderland is full of algebraic lessons. And to explain, we're joined by... Now, wait. Wait, just maybe I should ask, who are you?
Oh, what an introduction. Hi, Jackie. Keith Devlin from Stanford here.
Keith, have you been drinking something to make you tall or small?
You know, the interesting thing about radio is that no one can see what we look like, so they can have to imagine that I've got a very long neck and a very short body.
First thing, Keith... The riddle, the Mad Hatter asks Alice, why is a raven like a writing desk?
Yeah, that particular scene and lots of other scenes in Alice in Wonderland were a reflection on the increasing abstraction that was going on in mathematics in the mid-19th century. Dodgson himself was a very conservative, traditional mathematician, and he didn't like what was going on. To him, algebra was all about numbers, whereas what happened in the 19th century was people were developing all kinds of bizarre new algebras, algebras where x times y is not equal to y times x. And in fact, the why is a raven like a writing desk? What he's trying to say is the new mathematics that he didn't like, lots of things that every common sense person would say are different, in this new mathematics, they turned out to be the same.
So we just heard a bit of Tim Burton's new Alice in Wonderland film and the scene where Alice encounters the Mad Hatter and the Dormouse still at their tea party, the Mad Hatter and the March Hare. But I understand underneath tea is for time and that math underlies the madness.
Yeah, because one of the big developments that was going on at that time that Dodgson or Lewis Carroll was satirising was work by an Irish mathematician called William Hamilton, who developed a new arithmetic called quaternions. And the quaternions were numbers not to deal with counting things, but to deal with understanding rotations. Back in Victorian times, when Hamilton himself was doing this work, he tried to understand his new arithmetic in physical terms. And he said one of the four terms that was involved in these numbers had to be time. And when you look at what was going on at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, time was missing. And so when you take time out of
the character is missing.
Time the character was missing. And what Hamilton said was if you take this time parameter out of his new numbers, then the numbers will just keep rotating around. They won't go anywhere. And it was just like the characters rotating round and round the tea party, round and round the table. In fact, when the Hatter and the Hare try to squeeze the Dormouse into the teapot, they're trying to somehow get away from this complexity, throw away another of the parameters, if you like, so that life can resume as normal. So instead of trying to reintroduce time, what Dodgson is saying is, let's just go back to the familiar old geometry that we've had since Euclid for 2,000 years.
Keith, this may come as a surprise to us, but it seems like mathematicians have always known how much Carroll's been bound up in this.
Well, because we knew that Carroll was actually a mathematician, we've always suspected that, and we've seen some mathematics in it. Last year, in fact, a scholar in Oxford called Melanie Bailey wrote a complete dissertation analysing Alice in Wonderland, and she identified a number of mathematical illusions in the story. Most of us had sort of glossed over them when we tried to look for the mathematics in the story.
Interesting to think that another fairy tale that Dodgson apparently wrote that didn't have all the math underneath as a base was really dull, sentimental, and nobody cared. We don't even know the name of it.
That's right. And in fact, the very first version of Alice in Wonderland's story that he wrote for the real Alice, almost certainly what he did was said, here's this cute story that I've written for this real Alice. I'm going to take that and I'm going to use it to do this wicked satire of what I think are these crazy, stupid developments in mathematics that are getting us away from the real solid mathematics that I've loved all my life.
Keith Devlin is a professor at Stanford University and Weekend Edition's math guy. Keith, off with your headphones.
Thanks, Jackie.
Our next story also stars a young woman whose curiosity leads her to encounter some strange creatures. In this case, a sort of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. In fact, a lethargic amoeba that dramatically transforms itself into a sprightly two-armed swimmer when under stress. If only. Richard Harris has the details.
This is the story of an unlikely single-celled creature named Naegleria gruberi. It lives in the dirt under the eucalyptus trees on the UC Berkeley campus.
A lot of people call Naegleria a soil organism, but if you look in sort of dry, sandy soil, you won't find it.
Lillian Fritz Leyland is a graduate student at Berkeley.
It really hates to get dried out. So you'll find it in the mud, sort of, or in the pond or the bottom of puddles in the woods.
Now, these days, when you want to see what makes an organism tick, you order up a scan of its genes. And as it happens, scientists at the Joint Genome Institute in California were sequencing a bunch of organisms, and they had a little extra room in their DNA reading machines. So biologists at UC Berkeley thought, what the heck, let's throw in Naegleria. Lillian Fritz Leyland got put on the project.
So I started playing around, figuring out how to do that, and I really kind of fell in love because you take this organism that oozes and is kind of slow and clumsy, and basically you just stress it out, and it becomes this really fast, fun, sort of bird-like organism.
It spends its days as an amoeba, lazily meandering around and scarfing up bacteria. But when it's stressed out, it grows two long whip-like appendages called flagella. Yep, we're talking stress-induced self-flagellation in the mud on the Berkeley campus.
Instead of a sperm, like a sperm tail, it puts the flagella in front of it and sort of swims something akin to a breaststroke.
Of course, this transformation requires cobbling together a dramatically different cellular architecture to support this completely different lifestyle.
Naegleria is pretty amazing because it can make one of these structures entirely from scratch, and it does it really fast, within an hour to an hour and a half.
Lillian Fritz Leyland wanted to understand how that happens, and sure enough, there are clues in the organism's genes. She and her colleagues report in the journal Cell that this itty-bitty organism has 16 or 17,000 genes. Humans edge them out in gene count, but only by a few thousand. That isn't so surprising when you think of it.
I mean, we are very complex, but if you think about Naegleria, it's amazingly complex because it's one cell and it's doing a lot of the stuff that we do with our entire bodies, right?
Lillian Fritz Leyland is fascinated by Naegleria because she's trying to understand how complex cells evolved. But there may be a practical payoff as well. Naegleria gruberi has a malicious cousin named Fowleri, and that causes a rare human disease.
It's pretty nasty. So basically, if you're swimming in water that has a lot of Naegleria fowleri, and you happen to get some water up your nose, what can happen is they crawl along your olfactory axon. So basically, go through your nose into your brain and eat your brain. And you're dead pretty quickly.
She says nose plugs are a good idea in Naegleria-infested waters. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And that's all we have on Science this week. If you'd like to read or hear more, you can visit our website, npr.org/science. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Alison Richards.